Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Success isn't a goal, it's a journey. I interview the most incredible humans to keep your mind optimized for growth. So, welcome to the podcast. Today I'm interviewing Zach Abbott of ZBiotics, who are a really cool biotech startup engineering bacteria to sort of break down things that you probably don't want in your body or just make your body a more useful thing. So potentially gut bacteria, lots of future cool stuff. And currently you've been building acetaldehyde and to help with alcohol, basically because of that breakdown into acetaldehyde, which is just super toxic and not useful to have in your body. So it sounds like an absolutely ideal sort of gold mine of a business to have, but actually maybe sort of a bit harder than one would assume after all, which is going to be super interesting to go into and to find out about your journey and going through Y Combinator and all these kind of things. My pleasure to have you on the show. So firstly, can we just get a bit of an idea of who you are and like where you come from, as in like your background leading up to this?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, thanks Sam for having me. I'm a big fan. So it's cool to be able to chat with you about ZBiotics today. Yeah. So I'm Zach Abbott. I'm the CEO and co-founder of ZBiotics. I'm originally from Sacramento, California. I went to school in California and then I did my PhD at Michigan in microbiology and immunology. And after grad school, I spent some time designing clinical trials at an organization for pharmaceutical companies and drug companies before starting ZBiotics. So my background is largely in science, specifically microbiology, but I've also spent some time kind of learning FDA regulations and about clinical trials and kind of bringing drugs to market, and all those things sort of influenced how I formulated and thought of ZBiotics' path forward.
Interesting. So I guess what was it that first led you into science then that made you really interested in that? Like, was it just you kind of were inventive and wanted to change things in the world? Or I'll let you answer before I give you all the possible options and just like a tick the box of Sam's third option. That'd be silly.
Yeah, no, it was a little bit of honestly of those things. I was always sort of, you know, really fascinated with science as a kid. I used to dress up for Halloween as like a mad scientist and stuff. And I was like obsessed as a kid with Thomas Edison and inventors. I thought it was just it. And I don't know what it was about it, but it just captured my imagination so much. The idea that you could see a problem and just create a solution out of thin air that people would use. I mean, I think that that was one of the things that excited me the most, even as a kid, was the idea that you could apply a solution and then other people would use the thing that you made. And then that idea of sort of like engaging in people's lives, you know, was, I think, one of the most interesting things. And then truthfully, I mean, it was a circuitous path at the end of the day to science, though. You know, I was always very interested in it, but I don't think I ever seriously thought of it as a career until I really even started doing it. You know, in college, I studied a lot of different stuff. I ended up, you know, I majored in immunology, but I also double majored in classical history. And I like seriously considered archaeology as a profession, you know, and so I was kind of all over the place. I didn't really know what I wanted to do specifically. So it took a while to actually find my path. But once I did, I was very convinced I was in the right place.
That's good. It's a hard one to find, to be honest, being a human. And if you only have one path, it's a bit like, whoa, maybe I want to take like all the paths. And if it's a young person, it's a nightmare. You don't really know what you're going to be interested in for 20 years to kind of do for that amount of time. Confusing one. But I can certainly relate to the whole, yeah, just being obsessed with people that kind of invented things and just actually changed lives just because of they kind of found a way to do something or build something that just didn't exist before. So kind of used to get me super excited. And I think that's why I ended up going into business, just because it felt like kind of like I spend my whole time thinking of things, but you want to actually make them happen as well. It's kind of, it wasn't enough to just like theoretically do things and stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's exactly sort of like, for me at least, the distinction between like academic science and sort of like industry or startup science and, you know, biotech. It was all science. It was all very interesting. But at the end of the day, the idea of being able to apply that science to something that people could use or that you could commercialize was really what excited me more than sort of the discovery aspect of academic science.
So then what led to your PhD? Because you said you sort of realized that's definitely what you wanted to do in terms of like being in more of the science pathway. So why did you choose microbiology and immunology exactly? Was it a good lecturer?
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, microbiology and immunology specifically was, you know, I was just fascinated with disease. And I saw that as, you know, kind of on the theme of invention, a great kind of presented real problems to solve, you know, people feeling bad or getting sick or dying. You know, when I first learned, I remember as a kid, when I first learned about HIV, and I learned that it was this terrible disease and there was no cure and millions of people were getting it every year and people were dying. And so I thought like that, like grabbed me. It was like, I want to solve that problem. And so I ended up actually, doing HIV research. So after college, like I said, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And so I tried several different jobs. Actually, I worked as a bartender, I worked in construction, did several different things, but then I kind of found my way back to science. I ended up working at this lab at UC Davis studying HIV. It was an academic lab. And, it sort of like rekindled that fire for me. And I was really excited. And I decided that I knew that I didn't want to stay in academic research, but I also knew that for the things I did want to do, so just being a scientist at maybe a biotech company or potentially someday starting my own, having a PhD would be really important for my career goals. So I decided to go back and get my PhD. And so that really led me. And at the time, I thought I was more interested in the body's response. So I thought more interested in sort of the immunology aspect. But, as fate goes, some early work I did in my PhD, I really found that I was much more fascinated with the microbes than the immunological response. And obviously, I've come a long way off of sort of like HIV research, but, because I really fell in love with bacteria when I was working in grad school and kind of really pivoted and shifted into the power of good microbes and bacteria as opposed to the disease aspect. But that's kind of how it all got kindled and started.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, funny to hear they kind of fell out of science for a bit. Because I studied science and I obviously haven't really been doing it since. And most of the people I studied with didn't. But it's a very appropriate degree for business and stuff and learning how to actually be scientific in your approach to things. Because 100% it's like, working out if your product is going to actually work well in the market requires like scientific investigation and all these things and finding a niche in terms of things like evolution and all this stuff. I've gone about that for a while, to be honest. You then sort of focused on getting a PhD. How did you, because I kind of I'm not sure about the value of education. Do you think what you learned doing the PhD was the most useful thing that you did? Or was it the fact that you have a PhD? Because it certainly opens more doors for getting funding for your new business and stuff. And I have more time for you because if you sound like you know what you're talking about. Whereas if you just die doing this microbiology startup that maybe helps people with alcohol stuff a bit, it's a bit shifty. And do you think you actually learned a lot of stuff on the thing? Just wondering, someone that hasn't done one.
I think, both points are 100% true. The fact that I have the letters behind my name makes, a humongous difference. And there's tons of value in just that, for better or worse, obviously. But walking into an investor meeting, being the founder and also the inventor and having the scientific credentials to back that up always gave me just an extra boost in credibility in those conversations. And like you say, trying to organize it. Interviews with press or in podcasts, it's always nice to have that. And it has served me well. That being said, I definitely feel like I personally, and different people's experiences in school at all levels are different. But because I went back to get my PhD, 4 or 5 years after I finished my undergrad, and when I went back, I was there for a purpose. And I had a focus around what I wanted to accomplish with that degree. I felt like I got a ton out of the actual educational process. I became an infinitely better scientist having to work through a thesis project. I learned mentorship from my mentor and sort of the idea of, in a lot of ways, an academic lab at a tier one research institution is really a small business. And so watching my mentor kind of run that small business of our lab and sort of run the research and think through problems. She taught me so much. And so I really felt like I learned a ton. And, because in a PhD, truthfully, the academic portion of your PhD is very small. It's like you take a few classes the first couple of years. And then for the most part, the 5 or 6 years you're in your PhD, you're mostly just doing research at the bench. So it's sort of like just having a low paying job where in the best case are kind of putting yourself out there to just learn how to be a better scientist through doing. And you propose theses, your hypotheses and experiments, and you run them. And the first 2 or 3 years for most of us, and myself for sure, a lot of those are garbage experiments. They don't work, and troubleshoot your way through it. And I learned a lot, and I really feel like I'm a better scientist because of it.
Yeah, nice. Again, with the business analogies, it's the same with businesses. You try lots of different businesses and they all get tits up. You just learn to be a better business person.
Exactly. I think the first 2 or 3 years of ZBiotics looked very similar to the first 2 or 3 years of my PhD, I think, So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Cool. So yeah, did you ever think about taking your research further, writing a book on these things? Or what was the biggest take home from your PhD that you felt you gave to the world from your discoveries?
It's funny, even going into my PhD, knowing that I wanted to not be in academia and I wanted to do sort of applied industrial science, or not industrial, but industry-related science, I ended up in one of the most, basic research projects you could ever define. Basic research meaning not applied, very much about expanding human knowledge for the sake of human knowledge, just because it was interesting. I think as a scientist, you can get sucked into anything. It's sort of like when you go into those wiki holes, on the internet. I studied a bacteria called Legionella pneumophila. It causes a rare form of pneumonia, and it's a really fascinating bug. And basically, I ended up getting sucked into this like rabbit hole on gene regulation in the bacteria. And I discovered this sort of this family of genes that like had this really interesting and elegant regulatory kind of like balance they were striking when in different environmental niches that the bacteria was in. And so I was just spent my PhD sort of exploring and investigating that and kind of seeing where the bacteria led me. And it was great. And, you know, in terms of the project, it contributed a lot more to me and my understanding and appreciation for bacteria than I really contributed to the world. I'd say, you know, there's probably about 100 people in the world who would care about my research, unless something unintentional comes from it. But, you know, I did define a very, you know, novel and interesting family of proteins. And so anybody who's hardcore microbiologist who cares about CSRA proteins will go to my research. So
yeah, cool. Did have quite a few of those at my study back then. Did have some modules on that. Couldn't for the life of me tell you anything more about them, apart from that I remember writing about them and forgetting quite quickly. But they exist. Yes, I can agree with that.
Yeah. They're real.
Good. Nice to hear. Cool. Okay. So how quickly did you then go into, so you spent like a few years then working in immunology and stuff before ZBiotics?
Yeah. So between grad school and starting ZBiotics, I actually just have, it was 1 year and I worked for a contract research organization and basically everybody from, you know, big pharma down to, you know, small mom and pop biotech companies would come and basically enlist our services to design clinical trials for drug candidates that they had. And so I worked in business development. And so that was really, really fun. Basically, I was responsible for when a client would come, they'd say like, here's our drug candidate. Here's how it works. Here's like preliminary data that we have. Like, how much would it cost for you to run our clinical trial? And so to do that, we'd have to essentially design the whole clinical trial. And so I get to dive into the science and think about like sort of effect size of the drug and, you know, try and do statistical predictions on roughly how big the study would be. And then I go out and call all these different vendors, like, you know, clinical trial sites and drug manufacturers and all these things. And we'd sort of design this whole pathway and then we'd price it out and tell them and be like, it'll take us this long and it'll cost this much money. And what was great about that was that I just got to do the design and then like, you know, they either became a client or they didn't. And if they did, then somebody else actually executed and ran the clinical study and did all the nitty gritty. And I got to move on to the next project, learn about the next drug. So in a year, I got to design dozens of clinical trials and learn about all these really cool potential drugs on their way to market. And it was really just a really cool way to kind of think about science and how it applied to business and also think about sort of the regulatory pathways in a way that I hadn't gotten before. So it was really fun.
Yeah. Definitely. I feel like some of that stuff's missing in like degrees of science where they just kind of teach you like the core science, but you don't really see the practical value or how you're ever going to get it into the world and things. And I went to a hackathon last year with like Bayer doing the sort of genetics and like phonetics of things, sort of doing stuff. And so I got to meet like the head of innovation for Bayer and was like, why didn't I meet someone like you when I was doing my degree and like turn up to this kind of hackathons and stuff where we'd actually have seen like what we were doing and had to practically like, this is how it goes to market. These are the cool things we could have been working on. But you finish your degree, you have no idea what to do with it. And then you're like, oh, someone give me a job kind of thing. And then you leave science.
Completely. Couldn't agree with you more. Honestly, it's what creates the opportunities that companies like ZBiotics have. You know, obviously academic research is, you know, at the cutting edge, but for all of that, there are, you know, relatively speaking, very few companies that actually successfully get spun out of academia. And it's just not the way that scientists are trained to think. You know, we're trained to think about basic research and expanding human knowledge. You know, and for better or worse, it's not a criticism. It's just that for the most part, they're not thinking about what would actually be a practical application of the science. They think like, this is really cool science. This works. And like, that's really the only qualification or boxes they want to check in a consideration to maybe take it to market. And so you see a lot of science that either is a good idea that somebody just publishes and says like, you know, kind of throws over the fence and says like, how about it, industry, you know, and then just kind of walks away. Or they take some idea they really like, they've seen is really amazing, and they try and commercialize it, but they don't think about sort of the practical realities of kind of the public and the use case and those sorts of things. And so, you know, you see a lot of really cool science that sometimes you're like, that will never make it on the market. Like, people won't accept that. And they, as a scientist, think to themselves, but it's great science. Like, it should be successful. And so I think that because there's that sort of gap in an understanding between the science and like what actually it takes to make a business or a good product is the opportunity for a scientist to make a company, but it's also the result of a lack of, I think, you know, the proper breadth of education to set up scientists to think more like that.
Yeah, it's sort of basically, I think we can summarize that the business community has a lot to learn from scientists in terms of like achieving product market fit and sort of actually like focusing on like what is truth and creating hypotheses to test. And the science community has lots to learn from business in terms of like getting product market fit and like doing something that's useful and practical to the world and actually talking to people and then understanding the people that are going to use it and like taking the idea to market and making it happen. And yeah, they should all just combine some more. There should be a business and science degree. Like, why isn't this invented already?
You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's progress, right? Like, so in Michigan, there's like a Center for Entrepreneurship and a lot of the scientists and engineering disciplines, like you can take classes. And so they're building it. And so it exists. And my education was certainly influenced by that, but you really have to seek it out. And so I think that there is opportunity for improvement there to set people up. But I think, you know, at least when I was in grad school in my field, they said, I think it was something like 1 in 5 PhD students would actually become faculty at a research institution. And so I think they were coming to accept the fact that 80% of the students they were educating were not going to do this career. And they were starting to kind of try and set people up for broader opportunities.
So what were like the things that you learned practically that then sort of helped you start Zbiotics then?
I think that honestly, like the number one takeaway I had from working at that CRO, to put it bluntly, like taking your product to market as a drug through clinical trial pathways was not something I wanted to do. I'd see these companies, these small biotechs come and their goal was to just scrape together enough money to get enough data to kind of get past sort of like a phase 1 or a phase 2 and hope to just get it acquired or licensed to the Pfizers and the Roches of the world to take to market, because the amount of money and time and effort it takes to execute the necessary kind of phase 3 trials and the commercialization is so high. That barrier is so high that it's almost impossible to kind of own that yourself. And I thought, that sucks. Like, if I'm going to build something, I don't want to lose control of it. I want to be the one who takes it to market. And so that was a huge influence on how I started Zbiotics. When I started thinking about the idea, so Zbiotics is founded on the idea that we can genetically engineer a probiotic bacteria to execute a useful biological function in your body. You know, the amazing thing about bacteria is that you can literally program any biological function on the planet into that bacteria. And if that is a safe, edible bacteria, then you can eat that bacteria and temporarily gain that biological function. So it's sort of like superpowers in some ways. And so that was just such a cool and exciting idea. And I thought the possibilities are endless for what we could apply that technology to. But having worked at that CRO, I thought to myself, I should apply this to applications that people can engage in their kind of healthy lives as opposed to a disease state, so that I could sort of like maintain control of the product and also be able to engage with people about the product directly. The other problem I really saw was that, you know, people's perceptions around GMOs and genetic engineering, it was a lot of misunderstandings and misinformation and a lot of skepticism and outright fear around these products, but they had a lot of things that they could benefit, they could provide for people. But that fear went away when the product was a drug and when somebody really needed it. The grocery store of choice was taken away. People were like, well, you know, I'm sick, so I'll take this product. And so I saw the opportunity to use genetic engineering to make products that people wanted that had a direct benefit for them, and then be able to have sort of a direct conversation with them about that in a way that might be able to positively affect that conversation. And so those two things together kind of influenced how we decided to approach the market with the tech.
That's funny. It's a very big cognitive dissonance in humans that they're really judgmental of what GMOs they will like eat when it comes to like food and stuff. And yet, like, as soon as it sort of comes in like a drug format, which is obviously all very unnatural drugs that you're taking, suddenly a GMO is like, oh, it's a more natural thing. I'll take this GMO because it's like a healthy, and you're like, humans, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, you know, like it's understandable too, right? Like the idea that like, if your hypothesis as a consumer was that GMOs were potentially dangerous, like, you know, if you have a choice to avoid them, you will, but if you don't, you won't. And so I empathize with that choice, but obviously my goal was and remains to sort of elevate that conversation beyond sort of misunderstanding. You know, I understand the better safe than sorry mentality, but ideally, I believe that humanity needs technology in our food supply because we have a growing population and, you know, farming techniques that were hundreds of years ago, like the technology from like the 1700s and 1800s is probably not sufficient for a population that's like, you know, 10 to 20 times as large.
Yeah. And it's also completely unnatural and causing millions of other problems anyway.
Right, exactly. Agriculture might be the most unnatural thing that humanity has done to this planet. And so it's funny that we consider that natural. And so, you know, honestly, truthfully, anything we can do to make that more efficient and actually lessen our footprint on the planet would be better. But in any event, the goal was to kind of, you know, right now it's in a very fear-based place for a lot of people. And that's largely because the conversation has been one-sided. And so the goal is really not about like convincing people that GMOs are good. It's more about hopefully bringing the conversation to a more two-sided and rational conversation where people can see the benefits, but also understand the risks. And it's not meant to dismiss the things that people are concerned about. But so, you know, with ZBiotics, I felt like if I could make a product that people thought was really fun and they saw that there was a clear benefit to them, that they might be willing to like hear me out on what are those benefits and, you know, what is genetic engineering and really, you know, and those sorts of things. So that was part of kind of what motivated where we started with the technology.
Definitely. Does seem like it could be a good sort of ground for then making people hear out about more of the benefits of genetic engineering and other sides of things like food and stuff. But anyway, before we go into a very long debate about GMOs and things, I'm sure we've had like many hours of our lives dedicated to those things from studies of science anyway. But by our side, we both just believe it's great. So we can move on. Confirmed. I'm really happy to be promoting BetterHelp. It's a sponsor of this podcast. And they're just really great. And hopefully it can help you with any of the problems that you have. During lockdown, sometimes when I'd be recording the podcast, I'd be talking to someone in the interview and I would just mute the sound on my headphones. So I'd have no idea what they were saying. And I'd just try and carry on with the interview and see if I could do it without anyone noticing. I have no idea why I did that. Yeah, there's something wrong with me. Hence why I needed counseling. BetterHelp assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's professional counseling done securely online. And it's more affordable than traditional counseling, and you can kind of access it whenever you need it. And so my own counselor was brilliant. I really learned so much from her and enjoyed our sessions. And other reviews from people who aren't me, Natalie, makes me view my life from a different perspective, which can be so helpful. Another one, Dr. Amy, I feel heard and also received really helpful advice from her. So yeah, join over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. This is a special offer for Growth Mindset podcast listeners. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/growthmindsetpodcast.
Anyway, how long were you working on ZBiotics before you got into Y Combinator? Was it kind of like an idea and you applied, or had you been running it for a few years?
Well, so it's interesting. I had a sort of atypical path with Y Combinator. Well, the idea for ZBiotics actually had been sort of stewing and fomenting my brain for like 7 or 8 years before I actually started it. And to the point where, you know, I wouldn't even describe it as originally even thinking about it as a startup, just sort of thinking about that technology idea, the idea of programming a biological function to a bacteria. And that slowly kind of developed and changed and turned into something I thought could maybe be a company. And I told some friends about the idea and they ended up getting into Y Combinator with an idea of their own. And then they said, you know, and at the time I'd actually never heard of Y Combinator and I hadn't really thought much about startups and it just wasn't on my radar. I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneur or anything. And they were like, you should apply to Y Combinator with this idea. And I said, I don't know, you know, I'm not really sure if I'm ready. And like, just apply. Like it'll, whatever, you know, you don't get in, but at least still have thought through the idea a little bit more. And I'm like, you know, you're right. It'll just be a fun exercise. And so I applied. And at the time they had, you know, the core YC program, but they also had a fellowship program, which was just sort of a trial thing that they were testing out, which was designed. It was a small amount of money. It was a remote program. And it was just to get ideas from kind of 0 to 1, just from idea stage to company, which is exactly where I was. And I happened to get into that fellowship program. And so that was like $20,000. And 2 months. And that was $20,000 was enough for me to like the nudge to kind of quit my job and start the company. But it was really at that point, just an idea. And then we ended up 2 years later. So I started that company. I got a fellowship program in May of 2016. And then about a year and a half later, we ended up doing the winter 2018 core YC program. And so I'd already kind of was part of the YC kind of community at that point, having done the fellowship program. And so I think that was certainly helpful. But we made quite a bit of progress in that year and a half before we applied to the kind of core program and got into that.
So what did you need to prove to them? Maybe we should backtrack for anyone that's listening that doesn't know about Y Combinator. It's like the biggest startup accelerator on the planet, basically. And it doesn't guarantee success or anything, but it's pretty good validation of your idea. And a lot of companies have gone on to do really great things after being funded and going through the program. So it's kind of like the aspirational thing to get into if you're running a startup, just to frame the conversation. And so what was it that you had to prove over that like year and a half that then got you into the YC program in the winter 2018? And do you also think that like a lot of it was also due to just connections and getting to know the people better?
I think it's certainly without a doubt helpful to have sort of an internal champion. And I wouldn't necessarily say champion is probably too strong of a word, but like having, you know, I think likely what got it. So, you know, the process to back up a little bit is you send in an application, which is pretty short, relatively speaking, and they evaluate, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of applications. And then they invite a subset in for an interview. And then you get a 10-minute interview. And then based on that application plus that interview, they make a decision about whether they accept you into the program. So it's a pretty short process. And you can imagine with a large stack of applications, it's hard to kind of rise above the noise. And I'm sure that, you know, they often say that they end up turning away companies that are very good, that might be great fits for the program, but just because they lack the capacity and they get so many good applications. So I think certainly knowing somebody in the Y Combinator program helped me get that interview, I think, more than anything. When I put in my application, I emailed my mentor from the fellowship program and said, hey, I just applied to the core program. And she said, great, I'll take a look at your application. And so being able to just have that conversation, I think helps kind of at least raise our application above some of that noise, which was helpful. But truthfully, I think, you know, getting in at the end of the day, one of the things that helped was that we had a very unique idea. I doubt they'd ever seen it before. You know, ZBiotics' first product last August, it was the world's first ever genetically engineered probiotic ever. And so I think that kind of had a bit of a wow factor element that grabbed people's attention. And the fact that it was a biotech company, and again, that there was credibility in the founders, I think all those things served to separate us to a point where we were competitive to be accepted. That being said, I don't think that there is a perfect secret sauce. I think there's a lot of ways to get into YC. There's a lot of ways to have a great company and still not get into YC. It's challenging for sure.
Okay, good. So that makes me that much wiser in terms of just have an awesome idea, be awesome founders, and maybe you perhaps still get in, but might not.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, totally. I mean, you know, it's not to be discouraging at all, but it is like, I think that, you know, exciting ideas are great and, you know, traction is great and they want to see people who are going to work through problems and have already done a lot with the resources they have, even if they're very limited, to make progress. And they just want to know that if they're going to bet on you, that you'll do everything you can to make that bet pay out and you'll do everything. So I think that's one of the things you can.
So at this point in time, so you've been running it for like nearly 2 years then, I guess. Did it seem, because what's sort of the valuation that they put your business at when they invest in you?
Well, so YC is interesting. They sort of invented their own investment, I don't know what you would call it, like mechanism in the SAFE, which is a simple agreement for future equity, which they encourage you to use with, you know, all the investors that you engage with at demo day at the end of YC. And so what that simple agreement for future equity says is it works a lot like a convertible note in that it sets sort of like a cap on your valuation for a future round of where you actually get a valuation. So when you participate in YC, you don't technically have a valuation yet. And I think that's part of it, right? Because a lot of these are really early stage companies and, you know, you'd just be making a number up anyway. And so they kind of avoid that by saying like, you know, you're not really ready to put a value on. So we put a cap, which is to say that if you raise like above that, we get sort of a deal. If you raise below that, then we just get it at the price that you raise at. And so they have a standard deal, which has, I'm sure, changed, or I would imagine it's changed. But when we did it, it was, you know, it's roughly works out to about 7% of the company, if I remember right.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that like they give you kind of like $20,000 or something for 7%. And then the SAFE is like another 100 grand or something to invest at like the valuation that you raise at or something. But is it for the 7%?
So sorry, the 20 grand was just for the fellowship. With the core program, when we did it, it was 120 grand. And it was just, I mean, they arrange there slightly differently. They take like some amount of like a preferred stock and some amount of common and they arrange there. So to be a little more favorable for YC, but generally speaking, it's relatively straightforward. And, you know, it's mostly managed by this sort of the SAFE as the investment.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I was just a bit unsure. And if you've been working on your business for quite a long time and you feel like you've kind of got customers, you've done some really cool stuff, was it kind of hard to give away like equity at like a low valuation? But I guess you didn't have that problem. So not really an issue.
Yeah. And I mean, truthfully, what I would say is that if you want to fundraise, I mean, it's equity well spent, in my opinion. I mean, YC provides a lot of different values, but one of the things that they do which I think is pretty much almost universally true, is they really pour gasoline on the fire for your fundraising efforts. And so, you know, YC has a lot of credibility. And so when they arrange their demo day, investors come and they see you pitch and you're YC backed, you're YC endorsed. And so that's already a humongous like mental hurdle that a lot of these investors are already over in thinking about you. So if you're looking to fundraise, it makes that a lot easier. And so I would definitely say that I wouldn't be overly miserly about your kind of equity if you're considering YC, you know, because it's worth it.
One thing, so did you talk to many investors before YC to try and raise investment? Did they seem really cool, but then just not like deliver until you'd done YC?
Oh, totally. Without a doubt. I mean, I'd already done the fellowship program and I thought like, well, you know, so I had access to the YC community, which is a huge benefit of doing YC. You have an internal forum and you can ask other founders lots of questions and sort of network. And so I was like, you know, we have that. And so I don't know if I really want to do the core program. And so, you know, we went out and tried to fundraise and it was exactly like, you know, lots of investors were interested, but like sort of, it was the classic conversation, you know, like, this is really interesting. Come back to me when you made more progress. And we're like, well, we need money to make more progress. Like that's kind of the point. And so, you know, you have these getting investors over that hump. And then, but then we applied to YC and we got in and all of a sudden, like everybody was kind of banging on our door to invest, like, oh, you know, YC. And it's funny, like nothing about our company changed. Like we were the same company in the same place, but all of a sudden people were interested. So, and giving us their money now as opposed to later. So, yeah.
So did you get funds at all before you then actually finished the program on YC? As in just because you'd got in like a few months before you actually got there, when people started investing? Or was it, did you do the whole program and then get investment?
We did. They typically, YC, you know, advises you to wait until the end of the program and sort of then you'll have a lot of investors and you'll have the opportunity to kind of evaluate and pick maybe value add investors and things like that. That being said, we were in conversation because we had started fundraising before we even applied. We were in conversation with a few that we really liked already. And then sort of the last thing they needed to kind of get over the hump apparently was that we got into YC. And so we opted to accept some investment before the program, you know, for better or worse. I don't know if that was a good decision or not, but when you're a founder and, you know, somebody's offering you money and we've been trying for so long, you know, and like I said, we really like the investors we decided to go for. So we did invest, take some before, but most of that round we took after the program, you know, during after demo day.
Cool. Yeah. I feel like we're sort of quite similar in terms of like, I've sat on my current idea for Syncify like for like 8 years now, and I've been talking to lots of investors and like applying to Techstars, and seems like we're probably going to get into Techstars because I've worked with them a bit before and they seem to really like me and stuff. So it might not happen, but seems probable. But I just worry that we're trying to looking at raising money. It's like, we have this idea that could be really big. And you're sort of like, well, if it's kind of like potential unicorn thing is, and we need like lots of money to sort of deliver on that straight away. We kind of need to raise like $500,000 just to kind of go and prove that. But I don't know if we're quite at the stage where we can do that. And it's maybe trying to take too big a leap and perhaps, okay, we can just do an SIS round of like 50K right now, just sort of do some stuff over summer, get like a good dev and do just to like build stuff really quickly and get like product market fit faster to then raise like the $500,000 afterwards. And if we've been on Techstars, it would happen easier, but it's just a bit confusing is because you're talking to some like VCs that are like, oh, sounds like such a cool idea. We're really excited by it. And they really want to talk to us. And you're like, well, are they just going to like enjoy talking to us for the next 6 months? And actually we're like never going to build the product because we're still talking to people and it's a confusing one.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think like the YC mentality is on this is like, yeah, that like you will just spend all your time talking to these investors. And the idea is to just build it and launch it. And like, they're always are like, just launch a piece of crap, get customer feedback, make it better, get traction. And then the conversations with investors are a lot easier. And so I think that that is sort of the mentality that was sort of drilled into us as well, is that you just get out there and you talk to customers and you let them try your product. And, you know, I think like the famous example is like PayPal wasn't even built as a payment platform, sort of like one little feature and something else they were trying to build. But it turned out that's what everybody wanted. And so they made that. And there are, you know, a million stories of that variety. And so, you know, as you build something, you may think you know what people want, but it turns out they want something totally different. And so that's always kind of been the mentality, is like not to raise a bunch of money and over optimize something, but just like get something out the door and see how it goes. And then if it's successful and you get traction, then raising that money from those investors is a lot easier. So.
Nice. So what about you? Because if we go a bit more into your actual products, then you've had some issues with getting adoption of the tech, even though it sounds like such a cool thing. So did that not cause issues if that was like the first product that you really released into like to get investment?
Well, so our pathway was a little different because we can't like launch a piece of crap. It's because it's a physical product, right? That requires a lot of engineering and manufacturing and, you know, bottling and packaging. Like there's a lot of capital required just to bring the product to market, you know, the regulatory, a lot of regulatory requirements in terms of safety testing and things. So there was a challenge in sort of raising money there, which is that we had to have people invest before we had any proof. And so, you know, we created indications that we thought it would be successful based on performance of the product and the technology. And we give investors samples of the product to try themselves and, you know, make the case for why we thought this would be an interesting product. And beyond that, an interesting technology. We always pitched ZBiotics as a company that makes probiotics genetically engineered to benefit, you know, healthy people in their daily lives. And that the first product around acetaldehyde and alcohol is really just meant to be a proof of concept. And we always sort of explained it that way. It was a way to grab people's attention, get them to try the product, have a visceral readout of efficacy for themselves, but that we were going to make a lot of stuff with this platform technology. And that's the vision we sold. And so it wasn't easy, but, you know, when we got somebody who's committed to that vision, you know, when you get that first check in the door, you can sort of get that momentum going. And so, and the fact that NYC, those things together. But, you know, there's a lot of money just required to take the product to market. And that's what we were raising for initially. And now we're being judged on how the product does, of course. So for our next round, it's going to be much more about numbers and revenue, much less about vision and mission, you know. So, yeah.
Do you feel a bit, if you could go back in time, you'd have chosen a different product to launch with?
You know, it's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. I don't think so. I think it was a great place to start. I think it's a great fit for the technology.
It really has the benefit of doing some crazy shit with the technology that people aren't expecting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are without a doubt challenges that come from having chosen this to begin with, but there's also a ton of advantages. And so I think any product, that's going to be the story. Like, you're kind of trading one for the other in every situation. And so I think that this was a fun place to begin. And I think it, you know, it accomplished the things that I hoped it would, which is certainly gets people's attention. People like talking about it. Yes, it creates like skepticism and credibility questions and that we have to overcome and emphasize our mission. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, a lot of people are willing to try the product because there's not something out there that actually does anything. And so, you know, having something built with real science is something that gets a lot of people over that hump. And we're still working on how we communicate the product effectively. And we haven't certainly nailed that yet, but it's a fun challenge to have and it's a fun place to start. So I don't think so. I think I'd start here again. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. As a consumer, there's like nothing to lose in trying it apart from your money, I guess, but it's just it's a hard one.
Right. But we offer a money back guarantee. So, you know.
Yeah, that's cool. But as someone trying to get publicity and things, it's a hard one to try and recommend or advertise when you're not sort of advocating getting drunk and like drinking too much alcohol, but you're trying to like give the benefits of reducing the health effects of alcohol if you are drinking it. And you're like, oh.
It is certainly like a tricky line to walk. And, you know, we have the same challenge. And the product was not built to be like, go out and get drunk and like, here's your get out of jail free card, do whatever you want. Like, it wasn't meant ever to be a vice product. You know, it was meant to be something that acknowledges that part of a normal sort of social interactions for many people is having a drink or two or, you know, or three or four, depending on the occasion. And that like alcohol creates an unwanted byproduct, acetaldehyde, which is really not good for you. And in addition to not being good for you, it also was one of the major causes of how you feel terrible the next day. So there's sort of like a benefit for you and a benefit for your body. And we thought that if messaged properly and expectations were set properly, that that would resonate with people. And so there is a challenge. It's not simple. It's not like this is a better tasting ice cream. It's like there's a very like kind of precise way that we have to talk about the product to really allow people to understand what it is we're actually building, which is not a vice product. But that being said, if we're able to get the messaging right, I think people do end up seeing, you know, why the product is beneficial.
It's a sort of a bit of a hard one. It's a really cool thing that people do want to talk about and share at the dinner table, but it instantly goes straight to like, it's a hangover cure. Let's get drunk. And you're like, no.
Yeah. That's not the idea. Right. And, you know, and we get that, you know, and we see that from customers too, that, you know, I get lots of customer feedback all the time and I conduct a lot of customer interviews and people kind of approach it from a lot of different starting places. And like, some people are like, you know, it's a hangover cure and I use it when I go crazy or whatever. And it always like makes me cringe because I'm like, that isn't what this product is for. And like, it's not really how it's meant to be used. And I feel like they're setting themselves up to be disappointed a lot of times, you know, because it's sort of like a different social behavior than the one that we sort of designed the product for. And so that being said, you know, with any product, people will use it for what they use it for. And I can't really, at the end of the day, kind of control the way people behave, but we can talk about what the product is intended for.
Definitely. Have you looked much into like the benefits for like alcoholics? Because it must have a lot of benefits as from a health perspective for someone that is alcoholic, that's just consuming that and must be getting through so much like toxins in their body to be breaking them down better.
You know, no, we have not looked in that. And in part, that's because it's certainly not something that we considered as a use case for the product. And from a scientific hypothesis standpoint, I do think theoretically that more true to the point is that like, if you're an alcoholic, first of all, your body is doing things very differently than a person who is non-alcoholic when it comes to processing alcohol. most of the enzymes your liver uses to process alcohol and acetaldehyde are way upregulated. So they're actually dealing with the problem in sort of an interesting way. And it's creating its own, you know, health consequences that are obviously incredibly detrimental. And so I think in that scenario, ZBiotics is sort of like a drop in the bucket, truthfully. So I actually wouldn't think that this product would, I mean, it certainly wouldn't hurt, but I think that like the damage you're doing to your liver at that point and the scar tissue you're creating there is well beyond what ZBiotics is meant to deal with. So I don't think that that would be helpful.
That's a good, honest answer. Nice. Interesting. Thanks. Anyway, so we can leave the ethically confusing run into, but yeah, it does seem like you've had to spend a lot of time writing great content around science and sort of trying to push people to be sensible and spread your message in a nice way. Have you been able to get like much big press, or have people just been like, oh, I don't want to kind of touch it? I haven't heard about it places and such, but...
I mean, we've gotten some good press. You know, we had an article in Forbes and CNET. In fact, yeah, it was cool. We had an article in Forbes Japan, which is, you know, written in Japanese. And they sent us like a picture of their print magazine with the article in Japanese. And it was like, I hope this is good because I don't read Japanese.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've had some pretty good press. And I think that part of the interest the press has is because the product is kind of an interesting take on a lot of different things, both genetic engineering and sort of drinking and acetaldehyde and sort of a different message and a different approach. And so, you know, we get tough questions, you know, certainly, but those are the ones that I like the best. You know, they ask, like, I feel like they're always excited, like they're going to pin me down around the GMO thing. And I'm like, oh, glad you asked that. Let's talk. You know, there's that, or like, you know, is this encouraging sort of binge drinking? And I'm always excited for that question too. You know, we take a lot of time, as you know, we already talked, so I won't rehash it, but around the idea that we print right in the box, it's not just like that sort of like asterisk you see on alcohol brands, like always drink responsibly. It's like, you know, right in big letters in the top, it's like part of your first of many good decisions. Here are responsible drinking behaviors. This is where ZBiotics works. So it's really front and center for our messaging. And it's, you know, I've worked hard to kind of create an answer to those questions that I think resonates, because my initial answer was very scientific. It was like, well, we know that the correlation between alcoholism and hangovers is not related, you know, and like people were just like kind of glazed their eyes over and sort of felt like it was just sort of like a justification. And so, you know, working hard to kind of put it in context better.
Cool. Okay, so yeah, as I spoke about my own issues with sort of trying to move too fast and maybe just taking like smaller steps, but just sort of being consistently growing. What have been the things that you've sort of learned in that direction? And were there any big steps that you tried to take where you wish you kind of just gone like, okay, this is the next logical thing, do this? And like, how have you kind of learned that the hard way, or what have been the examples?
It's a really good question. And I think it's, yeah, it's the question that probably every entrepreneur struggles with. Yeah, I am I would say on the whole, a cautious person by nature. And so is my co-founder. And so we're usually more inclined to take the small step. And I think that when big step opportunities come up, we really try and push ourselves to seriously consider them, because the default is like, no, like, I don't want to spend all that money on this thing or whatever it might be. And so, but we, you know, we have made big step decisions before and they have blown up in our face on more than one occasion. And I think the lessons learned from that are really valuable. It hurts, but yeah.
Can you say what the thing was and how it blew up? Because of just like abstract lessons and not so useful.
Yeah. So I'll give one example off the top of my head. I'm sure there are many others, but like, for example, one time we had this, one of our advisors of our company is sort of, you know, he was an advisor for the company, and his value proposition as an advisor was that he was a like a highly networked and connected person. He's sort of like our home run hitter type advisor. He's the kind of person who's like, hey, I can make an introduction to this person or that person, this, or this famous person. And, you know, and so he's constantly sort of like bringing us these like opportunities, like, you should talk to this guy. He like runs this big hotel chain, or you should talk to this person or whatever. And so one time he came to us and he was going to like an NBA event. And I think it was like summer league, but I'm not positive. And he was like, you know, there's going to be this very like this VIP reception, and I can get you guys into that. Like, you can, not us personally, which should have been indication number one that this was not a good idea, but I can get like ZBiotics like at the bar and all these like really, you know, important and famous people with lots of like, they control lots of different sort of media and whatever will be there, and they'll all try ZBiotics. And, you know, but like, obviously, you know, people, brands like Nike and stuff pay like $1 million to be at these things, and I can get you in. And we're like, okay, you know, and he's an advisor. He's not like some random guy selling something. So we trusted him, and it had a price tag, which I'm not willing to share. It was not $1 million, to be clear. It was a very palatable amount for a startup, but it was a lot of money. And we debated, like, should we go for it? Like, this could be our home run, you know? And so we did. And it was just like nothing, you know, nothing happened. And it was so disappointing, you know? And I think, but in hindsight, it was sort of like these big step opportunities we thought where we were going to find, we were going to make that connection to kind of help accelerate kind of our momentum. And so you know, I think the lesson learned for me was that, like, there was no way to ever be able to track how effective it was. Like, who knows? We might have made an impression on somebody that later will pay off for us. I don't know. But the point is that, like, that was a terrible test because there was no way to track whether or not that was effective unless, like, somebody, like, tried the product once, was like, yes, ZBiotics is amazing. I'm going to put it in all of my hotels or whatever. And so I think that that was just one of those things where we hoped to kind of, we only saw like kind of like the best outcome and then think about like all the incremental things that should come from a good test. And so that was one of those hard lessons learned and sort of similar and analogous situations we saw with like certain consultants or, you know, service providers that we needed kind of promised us things and we didn't adequately vet those things. And then we paid the money and they didn't deliver. And so, you know, disappointing situations like that, where if we just taken sort of like the slow incremental growth on our own internally, we'd have wasted a lot less money and maybe we would have gotten there a little slower, but we also wouldn't, you know, have kind of wasted all that money and effort putting our trust in somebody else who we didn't know how effective they could be. So I think those are the hard lessons learned, but they're good lessons to learn.
Yeah, definitely. I think that on Y Combinator, I was listening to their startup school lectures. They talk about like, if you've got 5 customers, you'll like see these opportunities where you're like, oh, I can get like 1,000 customers if I get like this like huge PR deal or something. And you kind of shoot for these things, but like it's very unlikely they'll actually sort of take off. And you kind of just need to sort of sit back and like, hey, what can I do this week to get to 10 customers? And like, you can practically just definitely do something. And like, you should just do like the solid things and actually like really understand how things are working.
Completely. And like, that is always the message, right? It's like, just understand what people want and just keep building that, right? And at some point it will organically take off, but you can't just like, it's so unlikely that you'll just sort of like, you know, take that swing and hit like a grand slam. I'm sorry, I keep using baseball analogies. I don't know why I could do that, but it's so unlikely that you'll kind of hit it big, like on this like one little thing. And it does eventually happen. And you hear that story all the time, but I don't think you ever get to hear the context of all the foundational groundwork that took place to set you up to make that kind of big step. And so I feel like that every time we try and do something really bold, it just doesn't work out. And so it's just all about the grind, you know?
What has been the most useful things that you've been working on in the grind? Is it like putting the blog together that explains the science and like these things and like being able to communicate your vision faster in like a clear way? What would like have been the most useful sort of small practical steps that actually you just need to do each week?
For me, I think it's 100% communication. It's trying out, yeah, like you say, like we put together these blogs and then we get feedback. Like we go out and I personally call like customers every month and talk to them about what resonates, what doesn't. Like, you know, I thought as a scientist that like, look, if we just explain the science in detail and everybody understands how it works and sees how amazing it is, everybody will be convinced. But the truth is that most people look at that and they're like overwhelmed or they don't care or whatever it is. And at the end of the day, like what we found, for instance, in terms of our communication around the science, was that like for the vast majority of people, just saying that the product basically works like your liver, but in your gut, where a lot of acetaldehyde forms, is pretty much the extent of the explanation that they need. And like, you know, all the nitty gritty on how that works and whatever. I mean, and there's a very small percentage of people who really want to dig in. And those are my favorites because that's what I like talking about. But for most people, that's it. And so learning that and like kind of learning like how people engage with the product through just a lot of customer conversation and setting ourselves up to have those conversations with posts on social media and like say calling customers and soliciting feedback constantly, that little bitty grind each time, like refining that every word and kind of shortening as much as possible and just getting as much feedback as possible has been probably the most valuable thing we've done as a company. And all the other stuff we do has yet to yield the results that that does.
Interesting. Cool. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. My goal for this podcast is to help make people happier and wiser. And I'm also working on a few other projects in the podcasting space to achieve the same thing. I run the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with a friend, where we read and discuss a great nonfiction book a week, talk about things like philosophy, psychology, the economy, self-improvement, and business. Books such as The Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, Invisible Women, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a great resource. Most recently, I've been building an app, Syncify. It's really to level up your podcast experience. You can connect with your friends in the app and listen to the same things. So you can listen live in real time with each other or create shared playlists and catch up at your own pace. You learn so much more by discussing ideas with friends. It's really silly to listen alone. You can also discover and share brilliant episodes with ease without having to try and recommend podcasts in different apps and just it all getting lost and confused. So it's also good for combating isolation and mental health. I personally find social media quite antisocial, and I just don't find it easy to reach out to friends to chat for no real reason. But I do love doing things with other people, and listening to the same content means that I can naturally talk about the same things, and it just gives me that friend time without going out of my way. So I really hope that it can help you, and I just would love you to try out the beta version and help us build this. And obviously, do invite your friends. It's all about friends. So you can find out more about Syncify app by going to syncifyapp.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the show. If you have any questions, please reach out to me through the website at growthmindsetpodcast.com. I do love talking to listeners. You can support us on Patreon or by leaving a review on iTunes or telling a friend about us. But mostly, keep learning and keep growing.